When former South African President Nelson Mandela died on December 5th at the age of 95, the immediate tributes and then the gathering of world leaders to pay homage illustrated the global legacy of this man who had spent 27 years of his life in an apartheid-era prison. Mandela's name and his image are iconic for generations of people across the world. It's hard to deny that there was something deeply spiritual about the man, even as that part of his life has not received much public attention. But as we marvel at Mandela's ability to go from isolated prisoner to profoundly effective leader of his nation, the question of his faith is one I've been asked numerous times since his passing. Well, joining me now is a person with firsthand insights into the life and work of Nelson Mandela. They come from my good friend, Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell. Joan has known Mandela in several different situations. When he died, my first thoughts went to Dr. Joan Brown Campbell as someone who would be grieving over his death, but who could help us as she talked about his life. Joan, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm always glad to be with you all.
Please start by just describing your connection to Nelson Mandela.
Well, my connection to Nelson Mandela came from my involvement in both the World Council of Churches and then as General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. Both of these entities that are ecumenical in their makeup, which means, in the case of the World Council, 300 denominations around the world, and in the case of the National Council, 37 denominations within the United States, gather together on a regular basis and have been, in many ways, the voice of the churches, both worldwide, and these would be the Protestant and Orthodox churches. And there was a definite link between the World Council of Churches and Mandela, because their first engagement with him was when he was listed officially as a terrorist and was condemned, and which is what sent him to prison, because of their perceived involvement that he had with the Communist Party.
I don't remember, Joan, whether you saw Mandela while he was in prison. I know you saw some of his colleagues. What was your connection during the prison years?
During the prison years, my connection was those who were building the South Africa. It was very inspiring because here were people whose leader was in prison. But that bothered them not in the least, except for wanting to get him out of prison. But essentially, they were building the South Africa, including the writing of the Constitution for the new South Africa that Mandela was going to lead. They had no idea whether he was going to get out of prison or not. And the way I began to know all about this struggle was really in meeting with those who were in Zambia, which was the country that was willing to receive them. And this comes later in the story when we remember that Kenneth Kaunda, who was then the head of that country, allowed the South Africans who had been thrown out of their own country, that they had gathered there as their place for a practice of freedom that was to come to them. And they really, truly had no reason in the world to believe there was ever going to be a free South Africa, nor certainly a free Mandela. But it mattered not. They went right ahead, and they wrote a constitution that ultimately has become the constitution of today's South Africa.
Where did Mandela's ideas come from?
Well, I think they were born in many ways, not only in his time in prison. Before he was in prison, he was the leader of a movement that was already working toward a freed South Africa, free, that is, for those who were native people. I mean, we have to keep remembering that it was the Africans that were the people of South Africa, and his desire to create a nation in which he always, from the beginning, talked about black South Africans and white South Africans living together in a peaceful South Africa. And so this is really where his ideas came from. Mm-hmm. And he had built a movement even before he went to prison. He was the leader of a very strong movement. And it was many of those people that they had to leave South Africa because they were about to be either killed or imprisoned for their allegiance with Mandela. So already, and his inspiration came to them also from prison. Yeah. He never gave up on this hope and what he would write and what he would make available to them in a way that had to be carefully done. And one of the leaders was Thabo Mbeki, who then became the person who followed Mandela after his time as president of South Africa. So all this time, this movement was being built. Even though he was in prison, they were already building for the day when he would be free.
I know there was a connection between Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela, and so there was appreciation there. But Joan, was there an overtly religious component in Mandela's approach to life and leadership?
I think Mandela himself would say that he wouldn't count himself, to use American language, as a regular member of a congregation. But he was a Methodist. He would identify himself as a Methodist. And he did talk about religious principles and what they meant to him. So I would say, was he a church goer? And that's a little tough to start with. But I think, that to one side. I think what he would have said, but probably carefully, is that part of his own early training and childhood and then moving into the role that he was then playing when he was imprisoned, that the main, what we, Welton, would say, what really matters about what people do with religion, it isn't just religion, it's does it change you as a human being.
Right.
That part of his own structure as a human being would have been somewhat, not altogether, but he would never have denied the role that religion played in his own thinking.
Joe, do you have a favorite memory related to Nelson Mandela?
Well, I have a lot of them because I was fortunate enough to have a great deal of encounter with him. I suppose my favorite one was the privilege of standing behind him when he cast his ballot. A number of us had recruited to come to South Africa, and people forget it was extremely dangerous in parts of South Africa to be in favor of Mandela's election. There were still those who were objecting strongly to his election. And so one of my favorite stories that tied to that was really being in a church in the night before the election where they were praying all night long. And I was traveling with Kenneth Kaunda, who had been the president of Zambia and had paid dearly for his support of Mandela. And when we went into that church and Desmond Tutu was leading the prayers, the ties were so clear between the churches of South Africa, their prayers for the election, and Mandela's honoring of that very wisdom that helped him to be elected. The churches had no problem at that point taking a position on who should be elected.
Joan, I just remain stunned, I guess is the best word, when I think about Mandela's capacity for forgiveness.
Exactly.
Talk about that.
Well, I think the most famous statement that he made really was when he came out of prison and someone said to him, so what are you going to do? How are you going to punish these people that cost you almost 30 years of your life? And they went on to point out how he'd had to leave his family and his children and all of the things he'd suffered. And he just simply looked at the man and said, I will do nothing to punish these people. He said, if I do that, if I spend my time as a free man punishing those who imprisoned me, then I will be their prisoner for the rest of my life. And I have no intention of doing anything like spending my time hating them. That will only make me a prisoner. And I thought that was such incredible advice. When you think of the people who do spend their time hating, in a very much smaller way, people who are in some way misused by some other human being, And you've seen it, Welton, I've seen it, and they spend their lives trying to get back at that person.
Yeah.
And his advice, which was, if you do that, you are giving in to what to hate, and then at that point you become a prisoner. And I thought it was absolute wonderful advice for young people, for anybody struggling with life itself. It was a Mandela statement and totally amazing.
Joan, I know you've been a good friend through the years with Reverend Desmond Tutu. Did you ever hear Desmond talk about his feelings about Mandela?
Yes, a lot, and especially when he was General Secretary of the Council of Churches in South Africa. And he made it abundantly clear at all times that one of their issues was to free Mandela and then to build the South Africa that Mandela had dreamt of. So very much were they part and parcel. And when Desmond became the Archbishop, one of the people that he recognized at that point was Mandela and the role that Mandela had played. Winnie Mandela at that time was a part of the group of people who marched in before the ministers came in for that very ordination that made him an archbishop. So it was all very part of the same piece of the struggle. I mean, one of the beauties of the struggle in South Africa was, number one, their peaceful orientation, which I think did ultimately result in what I think is as important a story as the coming down of the Berlin Wall. Very few people ever thought that South Africa would become led by an African, and that change would come peacefully without violence. I mean, we forget what a miracle it really was. I mean, there was a country run entirely by people who had done everything they could to deny a full life to African people.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they were able to have a contract made between the president of South Africa and the incoming president, a white and a black, that they'd handed that over without violence, I think it's a tribute to Desmond, to the role of the church in that struggle, the role of the World Council of Churches, and the role of all these councils around the world that came to be partners in that struggle. And I think it's much more of a miracle than we really give credit.
Joan, you've had the good fortune of meeting world leaders in diverse places across the world. Where does Nelson Mandela fit among the people whom you've met in your ministry?
Well, of course, my whole life was changed by Martin Luther King, so I have to give him the first place because he played such an enormous role in the life of so many people. And mm-hmm. I, having never had the encounter with Dr. King that I had, I probably would never have been involved in the Council of Churches, nor been its General Secretary, nor had the privilege of meeting Mandela. But I certainly would put Mandela right next,
right,
along with Gandhi. And, I mean, I think these are the people of our time that our children will come to study and our grandchildren, and they will begin to see that greatness is possible, that peace is possible. And in the case of both Gandhi and Dr. King, of course, it cost them their lives. The one of the great blessings of Mandela was it cost him life in years in prison, but it didn't cost him his mortal life.
Yeah.
And he was able to live beyond his time in prison and see his dream come true, which neither Gandhi nor King were able to see that.
Right.
They played their role without any question, but I think Mandela's blessing was that he was able, but he also was put into the struggle of how you bring about, once you have power given to you, how do you bring about a society that then is the kind of society that you would wish it would be? And South Africa, as we know, has its struggles. I mean, a sad report was made that Desmond Tutu's house was robbed in the middle of all this. I mean, what a tragic thing to happen.
Yeah.
But the struggle for freedom doesn't come easy, ever, and we know that.
Joan, is there a chance that the attention being paid right now to his legacy is coming at a time where it might lead to a revival of what he demonstrated so vividly regarding reconciliation?
I certainly think there's a hope for that, and there's very, very clearly a need for that.
Yeah.
It was sad to see in the last 3 years, almost 4 years, when Mandela could not have a public presence. I'm interested to see what Gracia Michel will do, Mandela's wife. I thought the touching scene between Winnie Mandela and Gracia Michel, the two wives that we know the best of Mandela, who embraced each other. They had loved this man, both of them, mm-hmm. and he had loved both of them. And in a way, they could be enemies, as is often the case in wives and ex-wives. In their very own case, they illustrated already Mandela's gift to be able to help people to see the positives in sharing love, not in being filled with hate. And I'm hoping that as you watch the people, it reminded me so much, Welton, of the day when he was, there was an incredible thing happened, the day that he became the president. He looked out across the crowd, and he saw his jailer sitting in the crowd. And he called his jailer by name, and he called him forward. And he said, "I invite you to come and sit with my family." So what he did in that single act, he expanded people's understanding of family. He was really saying, this man may have been my jailer, but I spent 28 years with him. Mm-hmm. He is literally part of my family. Mm-hmm. He could so easily have made him the enemy and extricated him, not even allowed him in, but he did the opposite. And that kind of strength and those examples, what I hope is that people will begin now to tell the Mandela stories, just like we're doing now,
yeah.
so that people hear the stories and they're reminded how it was that South Africa became free. And we can only hope and pray that, in fact, it gives rise again to the dream, to the vision.
The Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell is the former head of the National Council of Churches USA. Earlier this year, she stepped down after 14 years as Director of Religion at the Chautauqua Institution. Joan, it's always wonderful to talk with you, but today you not only have enlightened us, but inspired us again. I'm glad that you've had those experiences. I'm glad that you share them. I'm glad that you are a friend of mine, and I think people will understand why I felt like you were the only one that could deal with this story in the way that I wanted it dealt with. So thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about this show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. You know we encourage you to tell others about this show, so encourage them to listen as you do, and then let's all get together and talk about this national conversation that needs to take place about so many different issues. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Mm-hmm.